Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I am Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Kelvin Gottlieb, Professor Emeritus at the University of Toronto. Kelvin is one of the most significant contributors to computing education, the profession and industry, not only in Canada, but also worldwide. Kelvin, it's a real pleasure to be speaking with you today, and thank you for coming in to do this interview and sharing your deep insights with the audience.
Thank you, Stephen.
Kelvin, you built the first digital computers in 1948. What were the major challenges and how did you solve them? And can you share two or more stories from your experiences?
There were technical challenge, of course, was to create an electronic computer whose memory access time would match the very short access time, operation time you could get from arithmetic units. So everybody was looking for a faster memory. Core, electronic core, magnetic core, and mercury delay line, these were all tried. The other challenge, of course, there we were a very young, inexperienced team. So we had to gain some sort of credibility, one with our financial agents and at the university and at National Research Council. And secondly, we were going around to a place in the United States with some very famous laboratories and offering papers, and things were very open. They listened to us, even though we were pretty clear, young and beardless. The one story is rather important. We had been doing some computing on punch card machines on the St. Lawrence Seaway, which at that time was being considered by United States and Canada, and decided that the way to go to there was electronic computers. When we got the Ferranti computer, that was the first major problem we undertook, and we managed to do with it a very large volume of computers on the computer, on the design of the Seaway. In fact, at that time, the United States Congress was reluctant to join in the joint Seaway. Well, what the Hydro Ontario did was calculate several alternatives. One of them was a Seaway that was joint with the United States, and another was a Seaway that went all the way through Canada. And when Ontario came to a meeting with the Americans, with the New York Authority, they presented a huge volume of calculations of alternative seaways, one of which was all Canadian. When the Americans saw that the Seaway could be built only in Canada, they decided they couldn't afford to stay out of it, and Congress finally approved it.
Well, that's quite an amazing and remarkable story, and especially since you've been sort of at the beginning of it all. What was it like to set up the first computational center in 1948 at the University of Toronto?
Well, we had the problems came, a number of problems came from other places. We had our own, mostly graduate students doing problems in physics and engineering and so on. We realized in the beginning, though, that since we were being supported by NRC and by Defense Research Board, it was important to make this a national effort. So we went to a good deal of trouble to offer to do calculations for research at other universities, which we did, actually. For a long time, there were more calculations coming from outside than there were from the U of T. Later on, other universities got their own computers, and as we geared up, we became the major consumers of our own resource. But during the initial part, we documented the problems we were doing. For example, one important problem was a calculation of radiation dosages, which Bob Bruce, who was then a young doctor at the University of Saskatchewan, eventually calculating careful calculation of radiation doses for cancer treatment.
Back in the late 40s, there were no university credit programs directed towards a career in computing. How did you change this in the 1950s? And it must have been an exciting time filled with many lessons that you could share.
I would state credit program started to come in the 60s rather than the 50s. And to get a credit program, of course, you had to prove that you had an intellectual discipline. Now, this meant you needed a body of literature. You needed a methodology that was pertinent to the subject you were dealing with. And so if you solved a problem, it shouldn't be regarded just as a problem in physics or chemistry or engineering, but there were some computational problems that needed techniques of their own. And then you needed some well-known people who had published papers of considerable significance using computers. So you needed to put all that together before you could get any university to say, well, this wasn't just a technical thing, but was really an intellectual discipline.
You wrote a book on the social issues of computing. Which issues still apply and which ones do not? And how has your view evolved?
The main evolving view is that social issues have really come to the fore. Right now, for a long time, I think I was the first book, and certainly was one of the earliest courses. For a long time, it took quite a while for courses to work their way into the curriculum. Right now, you have institutes at very prestigious universities, at Berkeley, at Oxford, whole institutes of social issues. And the first issue of importance was privacy. There had been a whole lot of questions about privacy of data banks, and so how computers are used for privacy and the technology of surveillance using computers is still very much to the fore. My own feeling is that the most important effect of computers is how they affect work. So many people, you know, you don't have to be programmers, but you have to know how to use computers. So they affect work everywhere, and that was important then. Other issues that we worried about, at that time there was the Club of Rome, which did a lot of simulations on what would happen to various commodities and metals and energy. People didn't have much faith in them. Well, right now, of course, simulations you can do, especially the simulation you can do with supercomputers, are very much affected. The doubt about simulations has passed, and computer simulations are now accepted. An issue that is fairly dominant now is intellectual property and intellectual property rights and copying software and so on. That wasn't an issue. And another issue that is very important today, of course, is phishing and identity scam and so on, and that hadn't surfaced yet. So there has been three or four major issues that have stayed and three or four major issues that have since emerged.
So let's say forecasting out maybe 5 or 10 years from now, what do you think the social issues for the future will be?
What we know about technologies is that it takes a long time for the real effects of a technology to make themselves felt. When printing was invented, it still took 100 years before books became common. And when the telephone was invented, people didn't know what it would be used for, and everybody thought, well, the telephone would be fine for a foreman to communicate with his workers. When the wireless was invented, it was generally felt that now that nations could talk to each other, they would argue out their cases, and therefore they would reduce the possibility of war. That was invented about 1800 Marconi, and of course we had the two greatest world wars we've ever seen shortly after the invention. So the important long-term effects of a technology are not seen for quite a while. When the horseless carriage was invented, who would have thought that oil would become one of the major industries in the world, and that our suburbs would have a whole spaghetti of throughways carving them up. So it's very hard to foresee what the dominant importance of computers is. Some people think that it will be the instrument for democracy, because you can, everybody can set up their own website, their own blog, voices of the people can be made felt. But the fact of the matter is that China and Iran are quite adept at stopping what they don't want on the web. So it's not sure that that will really be the route. What we do know is that computers are, instead of communication, is as much as calculation, and they certainly do allow a lot more communication between people's companies and countries. So I think that's the ultimate importance. They extend newspapers, they extend libraries, so they are certainly major internet of communication, education. Therefore, they will continue to influence society in very, very important ways.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, this brings up a side question when you talk about communications. You talk about blogging and try to encourage your students perhaps to research this area. What is their reaction to blogging?
Well, I have to find out. For the first time, I've actually in the class this year, I put an assignment on blogging, in which the first assignment is to do something on blogging. I asked the class how many of them had blogs. This is a class of about 40 students. Two of them had blogs. How many of them read blogs? I would say about a third. And another, all the rest hadn't read the blogs. So the assignment is to tell their experience with blogs, if they have them, why, who read them, and how often did they update them. If they hadn't read them, to try and read them and see, get a foreign opinion. And I gave them a list of about 20 or 30 interesting blogs to try out. Although blogging is becoming enormously popular, the students in computer science are pretty busy doing programming exercises and essays and things like this. So many of them don't have time for blogs, so I don't think the class I have right now is a real representative blog user. And I'll know a bit more about it after reading this assignment.
You know what, Calvin? We could do that as a follow-up podcast where you can just talk about just...
The results.
The results, yes.
Yeah, I'd be glad to do so.
Okay, we look forward to hearing about that. In which ways have your views changed since you wrote the book, The Economics of Computers?
Well, when we wrote the book, IBM was by far the dominant company. They had about 80% of the market, and everybody talked about Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. So, first of all, the market no longer dominated by one company. Now, the other really important thing, of course, is that we've gone from the mainstream to PCs to embedded computers, and that's technology that's still going on, where computers are everywhere and everything, and you know, when your refrigerator will talk to your microwave to your car. Which is coming too. So the inexorable effect of Moore's law, which has continued to operate and will probably go through another three more cycles, and if we get quantum computing, we get computing not using silicon, which all seem to be possibilities, that will still continue. So the pace of change is actually not slowing down. It's actually the rate of change is still increasing. So it's very hard to predict the extent to which computers are being pervasive and invisible. Nobody ever thought computers would replace typewriters. You don't see a freestanding typewriter at all now. It's all simply attached to a computer. Nobody thought that you would see a 6-year-old sitting at a PC operating a keypad or a touchpad and playing games and looking up Google. My 6-year-old grandson looks. A funny story is when he was coming to our house, he says, you know, he uses a computer at our place, and he'll ask you to use it at your place, but you have to watch him very carefully. We found that he was looking up Google, and he'd been looking up boob and bum bum. And this from a six-year-old, so he's learning the fact of life from Google. These are mind-boggling changes.
That's an amazing story, but also I guess it reflects the dangers in the technology, too, especially for young people who aren't monitored.
It does. It shows that this thing is such a powerful instrument and so easy to use that you've got to monitor what even the youngest kids are using on it. When I would drive downtown in one of the stores, in one of the buildings, there's a big sign saying, "The Internet is a dangerous place."
Yeah, so true. You know, it's interesting with regards to the economics of computers and your writings at that time. I mean, you were really one of the first prognosticators indicating the value to business. So in essence, I consider you a pioneer in its application to business and industry worldwide because of your visions and visionary aspects that you held even at that time many, many years ago. So, you know, we need to acknowledge that.
My own training was as a physicist, and I never for a moment doubted that computers were going to be important for physicists and engineers and medicine. But when we started to offer courses, we found that we had actuaries and bankers, and actuaries are always constructing tables and so on, and I realized that there is an important place there. And in fact, in the first book we wrote, High-Speed Data Processing with Hume, there's a long chapter on computers in the insurance industry, and essentially the chapter described file processing. The realization that computers were powerful file processors and therefore so much business was dealing with files made it obvious that there was another area of considerable importance.
I guess it goes back to this idea where you were indicating, you know, back in the 40s, there was really no sort of body of knowledge and methodologies, and really you were instrumental in pioneering those methodologies and that body of knowledge to really create this whole field of computing and all the different applications and the ways that it can be used. So, again, just an amazing lifetime of work that you've done, Kelvin.
I was interested in games too, you know, in a moderate way, a competitive chess player, and I thought I would like to see if a computer could play chess, but the Ferranti machine we had didn't have big enough memory to play a whole chess game, so I got a student who incidentally was at the time with the chess champion of Canada, to program the computer to do end games. Just king pawn end games. So he only had kings and pawns, and then could you make the computer play that? There's considerable skill in that. There's an idea called the opposition, which the computer did. And another area which was unusual and which drew my interest was music. And essentially this was pattern recognition. And I remember a very early program I had was to see if we could get a computer that would recognize whether a musical score was written by Mozart, Brahms, or Beethoven. Without being too ambitious, these would be one of the three composers, and could the computer identify the composer from the music?
You know, again, that pioneering work is the foundation, and now we get into quantum computing, and there's some forecasts that perhaps computers, you'll have the intelligence of one processor of a human being, and by, let's say, 2030, 2035, perhaps the cumulative power of all the brains on the planet will be on one processor. Do you kind of foresee that, and maybe computers?
Well, I know Kurzweil, there are people who do that, but you know, from the beginning of artificial intelligence, which has had an anniversary of its own, people keep saying computer mind, but computers will do mind work and artificial intelligence. But everybody also says that, well, we're going to get a computer that'll have the intelligence of a four-year-old. And that has been a constant goal, which we haven't reached yet. So, in any case, it doesn't matter what an artificial intelligence will do. What matters is what a mind plus a computer will do. So I don't think it's threatening that computers are getting more intelligent. They won't have the intelligence of people and personality. But the interesting thing is, what does a person plus a computer do?
You know, your wife is quite a noted author and writer and poet and so forth. Does she use computers a lot, or?
Oh yes, she has her own Mac. She's the Mac advocate. She spends about, I would say, at least 2 hours a day. She's a very slow writer, but she has a circle of friends, science fiction writers that go from Newfoundland to Victoria, and she's on with them all the time. So, and then she's a real devotee of astronomers, so she has a huge file of NASA pictures of the planets and all items by them. So she's actually, she's an English major, but she's a very heavy user of computers.
You know, high-speed computing has undergone significant transformation over the last 5 decades. Can you profile this evolution and where you see heading into the future?
Well, the real transformation is that Moore's law and reduction of cost and size has moved computers in more and more into everyday use. I never would have thought that when I go home in a subway and I overhear 5 conversations, 3 of them are about computers. the use of it and the talk of it and the application technology has really pervaded, at least our Western civilized society. It's very important that something comparable, and has changed our education, our method of education. We don't know the full effect of that yet. At the World Summit of Information Systems that was held at the United Nations, a very, very major set of conferences, the aim was to make sure that the advantages in education and learning that come about do also apply to developing countries. So as I say, the rate of, it's not just that the pace is slowing, is not increasing, the rate of pace is increasing. So we it's still very hard to assess, you know, what the ultimate result will be as computer technology. It certainly is important as electricity. I mean, you think of how electricity has changed our lives and it's so pervasive that you have to stop and think that it's there, because you just take it for granted, and everything you do is run by a wall plug or a battery, and computers are due to be and are almost that now, almost as pervasive as electricity.
I guess this sort of ties into some thoughts that, and I think in a prior discussion I had with you, where you talked about, you think now computing is sort of like a basic science, you know, almost like a physics or a mathematics or something like that.
Yes, I've heard other people say this, and essentially, physics, mathematics, and chemistry, for example, are called basic sciences. People have said that computing is, for one reason, especially, is that almost all science you do now, whether it's an environmental science or medical science or forensic science, collects huge, huge volumes of data, and how to handle it and categorize them and analyze them, analysis and find the connection between them is really, data management is central to computing. And in the technology, of course, right now there's a huge amount of attention being going to things like grid computing and supercomputers, which are formed by using the power of tens of thousands of idle computers working to a problem. So breaking down a problem into a manner that you can use it into these supercomputing. The first example was the SETI project and looking for outer space. So there are techniques now which are becoming necessary for almost all sciences, and that makes computer science, you know, it puts it into the top tier of sciences where anybody who's a scientist, whether a biologist or a meteorologist, will have to have some courses in handling data, which is essentially one of the main pillars of computer science.
You know, in your very sort of illustrious career, you were also a consultant to the United Nations and to the Canadian government. Can you tell us more about these times in your work?
Well, the Canadian government was at a time of the great interest in privacy, and there was a privacy task force. Richard Wynne was on it, myself, and we formed a report on privacy, which eventually led to the Privacy Act and the Freedom of Information Act. So that was that job. The United Nations, the General Assembly, early realized that computers could be important for developing countries. So when Newton was the Secretary General, he was asked to have a report prepared on the application of computer technology for development. They chose about six of us who are computer experts from different countries, and we put together the report, but it has Utah's name. The report turned out to be the best-selling report UN ever had, but it was done, I've forgotten, about the 60s or 70s. The recent World Summit was a very, very much bigger effort compared to that, because, of course, computers were, at that time, it was how to get mainframes into developing countries, and that was a formidable task, getting both money and people. And now the possibility of even relatively poor countries getting computers into the school is real. So much more interest came into it.
You were a founding member of the Canadian Information Processing Society, or KIPS, in 1958, and represented KIPS at the founding of the International Federation of Information Processing Societies in 1959. How did this come about, and describe KIPS's evolution and contribution to education, the computing industry, international cooperation, and to the computing profession?
As I say, when we got the computer, we found that our client advertised the presence of the computer outside. We found our clientele consisted quite a lot from bankers and insurance actuaries, educated managers, and so on. IBM at that time, of course, had punch card. It had entry into all those businesses. And also IBM was offering 60% discount to universities to purchase computers. So the fact that we had a sort of body of a potential body of students who were business was quite attractive to IBM, and they strongly supported us in that aspect. Now, that meant we had a group of interested people that was much larger than the academic group. There was an academic group, both in the university and elsewhere, but the business group was equally large. So one of the first subjects that I got interested in was sorting on computing, because sorting was so much part of the operations and time spent with punch card machines. But that meant there was a kind of an outside body that was supporting the computing activities. We thought we had two conferences that were just preceded the formation of KIPS. And when computing societies were being formed in the United States and Britain, it became natural to form one in Canada, which indeed was, at that time, was the Computing and Data Processing Society of Canada. And then when the half dozen or so countries that had computing bodies were forming an international body, then it became natural to go along with that too.
again, a series of remarkable contributions and really creating, in essence, the industry, not only here in this country, but also worldwide, also creating the whole educational framework in this country and also worldwide, and providing a framework for providing services from the United Nations itself. And, you know, Kelvin, you were really at the heart of all of this, and just really an amazing series of accomplishments and work over a very remarkable career. Again, Kelvin, it's always a real pleasure talking to you, and I really do look forward to, you know, just getting your message out, because I think it resonates with the entire segment of computing, business, and the consuming public itself. I think we're capturing an important part of history today, but also of the present and into the future. So, again, thank you.
Well, thank you, Stephen. I hope I can be useful in half the things that you attribute to me.